Purdue won these absentee votes in a landslide.
Absentee ballots tilt the scales for now in an Anchorage primary, but voter irregularities remain. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 28th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a national Republican group is investing hundreds of thousands of dollars to elect Mike Dunleavy as governor.
The Alaska governor's race is a very high priority, and it's a top pickup opportunity for Republicans.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
A very close Republican primary for an Anchorage seat in the State House widened today. Anchorage Republican Representative Gabrielle Ledoux was separated from her opponent, Aaron Weaver, by just 3 votes heading into today's count. Ledoux is now ahead by more than 100 votes after an initial count of absentee ballots this morning. But there are still some big unanswered questions about the race. Elections officials announced yesterday that they've asked for a criminal investigation after discovering irregularities with absentee ballots in the district, like 7 that were requested in the names of dead people. Alaska Public Media's Nat Herz has been following all of this and joins me now. Hi, Nat.
Hey, Casey.
Okay, Nat, give us the backstory here. Why should we care about this race?
Well, it seems like there's been almost enough news out of this one House district to like sustain an entire election's worth of news coverage. Basically, it all goes back to Gabrielle Ledoux, who's a Republican that represents the East Anchorage district, kind of abandoning the Republicans in the House and joining with a mostly Democratic majority for the past 2 years. And that's made Republicans really want to get rid of her. But the Republicans didn't really have an energetic candidate. And so the guy barely campaigned, but they were in a dead heat. And then all of a sudden yesterday, we found out that the division had discovered these quote unquote irregularities. There were, you know, these 7 absentee ballots that had been requested in the names of dead people. There were 2 people who sent back absentee ballots who had turned out they hadn't actually voted when the division called them and asked them if they'd voted. And so there are all these questions about where did these votes come from? What is going on here? Who is responsible and who is going to represent this district at the end of the day? I mean, basically, after the votes were counted, Ledoux was separated by like 3 votes from the Republican primary challenger. She was running against this guy, Aaron Weaver, who used to be a cameraman at KTUU.
So what happened today?
Today, the elections division counted about 200 absentee ballots that had been sent in. You know, there were only, I think, about 500 votes in the whole election before today. So, you know, these votes really had the potential to kind of change things. And it was an interesting process. Like normally with absentee ballots in a district, they'll open all the envelopes, mix all the ballots together and count them all at once. But today, because there's so many questions around this district and there are some suspicions about these irregularities, they had this like special process where they were taking the ballots and essentially finding a way to keep them with the envelope that they came in. So they had this kind of complicated process where they were opening the ballots and handing them from one election worker to another and then back inside a secrecy sleeve. And it was a process that took a long time. There was a little bit of suspense, and so much as you can have suspense with, you know, people sitting around in a room.
At the heart of this is the number of votes. And how did that break down today?
Ledoux won these absentee votes in a landslide. There were about 150 ballots that there were not sort of suspicions about, and Ledoux won about 3/4 of those. And so that, you know, put her ahead pretty clearly. But then what was interesting was they counted 26 more absentee votes that there were questions about, authenticity questions. And it turns out that Ledoux won every single one of those 26 votes, which really raised people's eyebrows about sort of what is the source of those suspicious votes and whether there's any connection to Ledoux's campaign.
Yeah, what do we know about that?
Well, right now, all we're being told by official sources is that, you know, there are irregularities. And as far as the source of these irregularities, we can't get any details. Meanwhile, though, you've got the Republican Party that is sort of looking at some of the information about who requested absentee ballots and the number of people that requested absentee ballots in particular places, and is linking it to Ledoux's campaign, particularly to a consultant that she's hired, I think, both this year and in the past to do kind of outreach work in minority communities, in particular with the Hmong community in her district. But they don't have any evidence right now that is directly linking the irregularities that the state is talking about to Ledoux's campaign. Nonetheless, Republicans are saying that even with the results from today being pretty decisive, now they're talking about mounting a write-in campaign against Ledoux, kind of saying she has no place in the legislature.
I guess the question now is, what is Ledoux saying about all this?
She's been pretty quiet for a couple of days. She wasn't talking to reporters yesterday, but then just before we went on the air, she sent out a statement where she did acknowledge hiring this consultant to do some outreach and get out the vote work. But she also said, you know, she's never tried to manufacture votes, and basically said that that would be a really stupid move in this day and age where you can kind of find all this information on the internet.
Well, thanks for following all this, Nat, and for being here.
Thanks for having me, Casey.
The Republican Governors Association is buying TV ads to help elect new nominee for governor Mike Dunleavy. After Dunleavy's primary win last week, the association spent more than $200,000 for ads in Alaska. The Washington, D.C.-based association has been buying TV ads in Alaska since the spring. It's paying for the ads through the Alaska-based group Families for Alaska's Future. There's been nearly $1.7 million in total this year in ad buys from the RGA and Families for Alaska's Future, with the Anchorage and Fairbanks Network affiliates. Most of the money has gone to KTUU-TV in Anchorage. John Thompson is the spokesman for the Republican Governors Association.
The Alaska governor's race is a very high priority, and it's a top pickup opportunity for Republicans.
There are 36 gubernatorial elections this year, and the Republicans are defending seats in 26 of them. Thompson says Alaska presents a unique opportunity for the party to pick up a seat. The Republican Governors Association is dedicated to electing and supporting Republican governors. In previous years, the association has been funded by corporate donors. They included the businesses owned by prominent party donors Sheldon Adelson and the brothers Charles and David Koch. The regulator that oversees oil and gas drilling in Alaska wants to increase the bond amount it charges the companies that drill in the state. The bonds are meant to cover the cost of plugging wells and abandoning them, but in some cases it's not enough. For example, the state currently has just one $200,000 bond to cover the cost of plugging and abandoning all of BP's wells at Prudhoe Bay. Hollis French is a commissioner at the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. He says that when a company goes bankrupt or stops operating and leaves without plugging its well properly, the state is on the hook to pay for cleanup.
You know, I think the easy way to think about bonds is like a security deposit on an apartment. When you rent an apartment, you put down a security deposit to make sure you leave it just the way you found it. And it's the same concept with these wells. If you clean up yourself and do all the work, then you get your bond back. But if you don't, the landlord, the state, is holding some money to do the work itself.
The commission is proposing a sliding scale based on how many wells an operator has. Hollis says the commission will collect additional bonds from companies already operating in the state. In BP's case, the company would owe the state about $20 million. Hollis French says companies will have a four-year grace period to come up with the money. The commission is taking comments on the new fees until October 16th and will hold a public hearing on that day in Anchorage. French says the commission hopes to have the new regulations in place by the beginning of 2019. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the University of Alaska is working to increase the number of teachers coming from the state.
Students need to form relationships with the teachers, and if there's a fear that they're going to leave after a year, it's hard to invest.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
The family of a Juneau man shot by police in Fairbanks is demanding answers over what led up to his death. As KTOO's Jake Steinberg reports, 8 months later, authorities say they're still investigating.
Cody Ayer died on Christmas Eve. His family says the 20-year-old was feeling depressed He'd been drinking and left the house on foot to clear his head in the cold night air. His mother, Magdalena Rose Eyre, followed him in the family car. Concerned that he wasn't dressed for 15 below, she called for help.
I was telling the police where he was at, and at one point, I just broke down and started crying and said, "Please save my baby. Please save my son."
She told authorities Cody had a .22 revolver in a hip holster. He was in the habit of carrying it while he worked construction in the bush. Fairbanks police and Alaska state troopers arrived and talked to him on the side of the road.
And he just wanted to be left alone and to walk.
Police closed the road, and Magdalena lost sight of her son. Officials say at about 7:34 p.m., more than an hour after his mother called 911, Cody Eyre brandished his pistol towards police. Three state troopers and two Fairbanks city officers opened fire.
It sounded to me like one of those black cat fireworks.
Now it's been over 8 months, and we still don't know anything additional as to what happened to him and why lethal force was necessary than we did the night we lost him.
That's Cody's sister, Samantha Eyre Harrison, who lives in Juneau. Authorities named officers who fired their weapons. To date, that's all they've released. The family paid for an independent autopsy. They sent the body to a specialist in Michigan.
Cody had been shot numerous times. His right lower leg was barely attached to his body, but he ended up passing because of a shot that was directed towards the back of his head.
In Alaska, when troopers kill someone, it's investigated internally. Then it's referred to the state's Office of Special Prosecutions to review if force was justified. John Skidmore heads the Department of Law's Criminal Division. He says that prosecutors rely on police to do the field work.
The investigations themselves, those investigative efforts are conducted by law enforcement. We don't actually have law enforcement personnel that work for us directly.
The family's attorney, Mark Choate, says that's a problem.
My big concern is that the same folks that are involved in investigation are also the troopers. You've got law enforcement investigating itself.
Prosecutors can bring criminal charges against police. Skidmore says it's pretty cut and dry whether force is justified.
If there wasn't force displayed towards you, you would not be authorized to use force generally. It's just the way the law works.
The Eyre family suspects race was a factor in their case. Cody Eyre was Alaska Native.
You hear a lot about unarmed black men being shot and killed by the police. Most people would be surprised to learn that Native Americans and Alaska Natives are killed in police encounters at a higher rate than any other racial or ethnic group.
The family says it's preparing to file a federal civil rights lawsuit for access and monetary damages.
We're worried that what happened to him is going to be swept under the rug, that things are going to start going missing, and that, you know, if you wait long enough, the public's interest is going to decrease. We don't want people to forget about Cody.
The case remains under review by the Office of Special Prosecutions. In Juneau, with help from Jacob Resnick, I'm Jake Steinberg.
A transport driver is dead and cleanup continues after a fuel tanker bound for Prudhoe Bay rolled down an embankment on the Dalton Highway early Friday morning. The driver, Joy Wiebe, was a Fairbanks resident who had been a transport driver in Alaska for years. She had worked for Alaska-based Colville Inc. for about 4 months, according to a statement from the company. Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation is monitoring the incident as the tanker Wiebe was hauling had several thousand gallons of diesel fuel in it. Nearly 1,780 gallons of that diesel spilled, all but a few hundred gallons of it has been recovered. Colville Inc. is still working on a plan for the site that includes soil sampling and environmental remediation. The state identified fiber optic cables and a gas pipeline near the spill site that may be impacted. The spill is in the tundra and could also threaten caribou, fox, and migratory birds. According to a report from the Pentagon, a Chinese spy ship sailed near the Aleutian Islands last year, likely to monitor a missile test underway at the Kodiak spaceport. That's according to a story Monday in the Kodiak Daily Mirror newspaper. The U.S. military conducted two tests of its terminal high-altitude area defense system at the Pacific Spaceport Complex in July 2017. It was unclear which of the two tests was likely monitored by the Chinese, according to the report, which was titled Military and Security Developments Involving the People's Republic of China, released publicly on August 21st. The THAAD missile's defense system, manufactured by American company Lockheed Martin, is a missile interceptor designed to destroy ballistic missiles in their late stage or terminal flight phase. Last summer's test missiles intercepted dummy targets fired from military jets near Hawaii. Both tests were successful, according to the Missile Defense Agency. The report, an annual document mandated by Congress since 2010, outlines economic, strategic, and military progress made by the world's most populous country. Representatives of the Alaska Aerospace Corporation, which owns and operates the spaceport situated on Kodiak's Narrow Cape, told the Kodiak Daily Mirror newspaper that they could not comment on the probability of Chinese spying because of confidentiality agreements with the U.S. military. A public hearing was held in Bethel today about Donlin Gold's plans to clean up its proposed mine and how they will pay for the cleanup. The proposed gold mine could be one of the biggest in the world if completed, and this step is essential before it begins mining. Christy Schallenberger with Alaska's Energy Desk reports.
Cleaning up a mine is an expensive endeavor, and it's a time-consuming one.
We've learned from the past. We've advanced through the environmental review process.
That's Dan Graham. He's in charge of Donlin Gold's reclamation plans and permitting process. Reclamation is relatively new in the long history of mining in the United States. It came to existence in the late 20th century as more information came to light over the damage that mining does to the environment. What it means is that mining companies must restore the patch of land that they mined, and, according to Alaska law, they have to pay for it.
So the state, PKC, Calista, we will not be on the hook to pay for the reclamation and closure.
That's Andrea Gusty, the vice president of the Kuskokwim Corporation. They own the surface rights to the proposed mine site, while the Calista Regional Native Corporation owns the subsurface rights. Both are major players in drafting the reclamation plan. The reclamation plan and paying for it are separate permits, but they go hand in hand in Alaska. Both have to be approved by the State Department of Environmental Quality and Department of Natural Resources before the mine can move forward. Donlin's draft reclamation plan is 400 pages long, and it explains in detailed technical language how it plans to reclaim the mine site during operations and after. The gold mine would permanently disturb about 3,500 acres of wetlands in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta and would permanently eliminate two salmon streams. It also requires big treatment facilities for the cyanide used during mining and the mercury that would be released from the rocks. And it has a tailings dam that is a mile long and a mile wide. All that has to be cleaned up after the mine closes. So how is Donlin going to do that?
So there's two phases. The first part is the physical closure and reclamation, which is a topsoiling, reseeding, revegetation.
That takes place while the mine is still operating, and shortly after it closes. And then, once the mine shuts down, Donlin will divert the water it uses during operations into a pit lake and let it sit for about 50 years until Donlin begins monitoring the water forever. Closing the mine and monitoring is pretty expensive. So Donlin Gold must set aside a certain amount in a bond that will pay for the reclamation during its mining.
I'm going to give you ballpark numbers here, about $240 million. And then there's a second funding mechanism that will be in place to cover the long-term treatment of the long-term operation of the water treatment facilities.
That funding mechanism will likely be a trust fund account that would be used to pay for the monitoring in perpetuity.
And that is estimated to be roughly $100 million.
But discussions around the trust fund are still ongoing. The mine can't move ahead until the issue is settled. Meanwhile, Donlin Gold has already received two major federal permits this month. It expects to have most of the major ones out of the way this year. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Christy Schallenberger in Bethel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. You know your teenager is struggling, friends have changed, grades have dropped, and when you try to talk, they argue or ignore you. Don't wait until it gets worse. Take action by calling Alaska Crossings. Alaska Crossings has helped hundreds of teens gain back their confidence and self-esteem in a full, fun, outdoor environment. The program is now accepting applications for troubled teens ages 12 to 18. Visit AlaskaCrossings.org and apply today. Alaska Crossings. Youth succeed here. This message sponsored by Alaska Crossings.
Fall classes started this week for University of Alaska students across the state. In Juneau, the Alaska College of Education officially opened its doors as well. While students can still earn a teaching degree at any of the university's three main campuses, the Education College's administration is based at the University of Alaska Southeast. And as KTOO's Adeline Baxter explains, the university has major plans to grow Alaska's teacher pool.
When CAKE resident Louise Kadake first found out she had won the 2018 Teach for Alaska scholarship, she was confused. UA staff had arranged for her to join University President Jim Johnson on a video conference call, telling her she was one of five finalists. When he told her the real news, she thought he was speaking to someone else.
Yeah. So he's talking about you, Louise.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're the only person I can see.
She can see it that way.
Kadake won a $12,000 undergraduate scholarship to study education at UAS. It's letting the 21-year-old pursue the plans she put on hold after giving birth to her now 2-year-old son, Braxton. She says she's known she wanted to be a teacher since she was a sophomore in high school. Since graduating as valedictorian in 2015, she's worked with kids in her community and as a paraeducator in CAKE City Schools last year. She says her coworkers encouraged her to apply for the scholarship. Once she gets her degree, she wants to return to CAKE and teach elementary school. Recruiting students like Kadake, rural Alaskans and Alaska Natives with a passion for teaching, is one of the main jobs of the new Alaska College of Education. According to the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development, there were just under 8,000 full and part-time teachers in the state last school year. That number has declined by about 500 teachers since 2010. The college's new executive dean, Steve Atwater, is tasked with helping the university reach its goal to see 90% of Alaska's teachers trained in-state by 2025. According to the university, two-thirds of the state's teachers come from outside. Many of them end up in rural villages. Atwater says they often lack the training or cultural understanding to connect with students.
What you have is a churn of teachers in rural Alaska, and it doesn't really help the students in terms of their achievement. The students need to form relationships with the teachers, and if there's a fear that they're going to leave after a year, it's hard to invest.
Atwater himself came from out of state. After training at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, he spent 2 decades in rural Alaska schools. He says he witnessed the churn firsthand with talented teachers arriving, only to realize they were unprepared for the challenges of living in remote villages. To fix that, Atwater says they're narrowing in on 3 specific areas: recruitment, preparation, and retention. Teacher-specific scholarships and investing in existing programs like Educators Rising, a career pathway for high school students, are a big part of that. Atwater said the college will also hire a full-time recruiter based in Juneau. Besides undergraduates and high school students, they'll also look to college graduates who may already be in the workforce but considering a career change. Improving teacher preparation will hinge on finding operational efficiencies between the 3 campuses.
Really, what it's going to take is the collaboration among all 3 units to come up with best practices and share best practices, and really to think in terms of operating as a unit, even though we are issuing separate degrees at the 3.
Looking at retention strategies, the university wants to expand its role in the Alaska Statewide Mentoring Project, partnering with school districts to provide support for early career teachers. As for campus-specific changes, Atwater said classes and faculty remain largely the same. Later on, they may look to have campus programs concentrate in specific areas of education, like special ed or early childhood. In Juneau, I'm Adeline Baxter.
August is often wet in Anchorage, but this year feels exceptionally so, with 26 days consecutive of some rain. But Brian Brettschneider with our Ask a Climatologist segment says there are different ways to look at just how rainy it has been in Alaska's largest city this August. It's a little sunnier now. I talked to him yesterday right as the weather was breaking.
For the number of days that it's rained, we're probably at about the number 10 spot out of the last 65 years. So it's definitely rained more days than not, but we haven't had a lot of big rain days. We've only had about 2 or 3 maybe days where it kind of was rained all day long. So even though our rainfall is above normal, if it seems like it's been rainier, perhaps that's because it's been more frequent rain. Well, we're running about 1 inch above normal. So through the 26th of August, we've had about 3.4 inches, and normal would be about 2.4. For an entire month of August, we would expect right at 3 inches. So even if it didn't rain, you know, for the last few days of the month, it would end up being an above normal August, but not excessively so. I mean, we've had Augusts with 7, 8, 9 inches of rain, and you know, there's a big step up between say 3.5 inches and 9.
But are we seeing rainier periods as the years go on?
Long-term trend, there's really not much of a trajectory either up or down with August, September rainfall. It's a rainy time of year, and there's been some big rain years, you know, 40, 50, 60 years ago, some big rain years in the last few years. But also, I mean, we had an August 2 or 3, 4 years ago where there was like a half an inch of rain the entire month. So no really long-term trends are discernible.
So we've been talking about rain kind of this whole month, but then of course today we get up and the sky is a little clearer. And you were telling me about sort of where the rain that happened this morning actually landed in terms of how it's counted.
Looks like we're probably going to end a streak of 26 days in a row with any precipitation, whether it's you know, half an inch, 3/4 of an inch, or even a trace of precipitation. 26 days in a row, our second longest streak on record at the Anchorage International Airport, which their record started in 1952. It actually rained at 12:54 a.m., and that was the last time. That's when the rain stopped. But it turns out a climate day runs from midnight to midnight standard time. So for daylight saving time, it would actually run from 1 a.m. to 1 a.m. So any rain that falls between midnight and 1 a.m. daylight saving time actually counts toward yesterday. So it looks like the streak is going to end because that rain counted toward yesterday. Back in the year 2010, we actually went 31 days in a row where we had rainfall between late July and late August. So that's the all-time record. Most of our records actually end up being this time of year. But it turns out in most of Alaska, those kind of record streaks occur in the winter months, where you can just, even a little bit of atmospheric disturbance can usually squeeze out a few snow flurries if it's pretty cold out. So you may end up with cases where there's, you know, weeks in a row where there's a few snow flurries with the occasional measurable snow mixed in, but that's where you get your big streaks for places that are a little farther to the north of Anchorage.
Brian Brett Schneider is a climatologist based in Anchorage with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He checks in every other week as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send that to news@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Nat Herz in Anchorage, Dacia Eaton in Kodiak, Rasha McChesney, Andrew Kitchenman, Jake Steinberg, and Adeline Baxter in Juneau, and Christy Schallenberger in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. And by Strong Hearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.